Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Rahm Emanuel out at the White House this week, hot temper on the campaign trail, and deep reporting on the struggle over the war in Afghanistan. The White House chief of staff is headed back to Chicago, wants to run for mayor. Here's Press Secretary Robert Gibbs on Rahm.
There is not an important thing that has happened in this administration that we've been able to accomplish for the American people that has not involved heavily his signature.
New York's Republican Tea Party candidate for governor Carl Paladino has run on anger. This week, it boiled over as he accused the New York Post of harassing his 10-year-old daughter from an extramarital affair.
You send another goon to my daughter's house and he'll take you out, buddy.
You're going to take me out?
Yeah.
How are you going to do that?
Watch.
And we will talk this hour with Bob Woodward on Afghanistan and the revelations of his new book, Obama's Wars.
He wants out. He said, I'm not doing 10 years. I am not doing never-ending nation building. I'm not going to spend $1 trillion.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Pulitzer Prize winner Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. We'll hear later in this hour from the intrepid Bob Woodward. And a big welcome to our newest On Point listeners at KSTX-FM, Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Great to have you. You can join the conversation right now with Rahm Emanuel out and the Tea Party hot, furious. Where's the White House headed? How about Washington? What's your top story this week? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Nancy Cordes, you're there in Washington. The president announcing today Rahm Emanuel will go. What does it mean for the White House, Nancy?
Well, this was the worst-kept secret in Washington, Tom.
Yeah.
Everyone always knew that Rahm Emanuel had wider political ambitions, that he would want to return to Chicago at some point for a race like this. And so all week long, the White House kind of said, well, we're going to have a personnel decision on Friday. We can't tell you exactly what it is. But everyone knew it was that Rahm Emanuel would be out and Pete Rouse would be in. He's a longtime, well-trusted advisor to the president. He's well-known in Washington. He spent 30 years as a chief of staff on Capitol Hill. So this is not, he's an interim post. So we don't know who will be taking Rahm Emanuel's position in the long term. But for now, this is a choice that most in Washington are very comfortable with because they all know and like Pete Rouse.
Bill McKenzie in Dallas, Rahm Emanuel was very hot-blooded himself. He was very politically minded, knew Obama well. That's why he brought him to the White House to deal with the Congress. Now he's going. He's not the only one. David Axelrod and others. What do you see coming here, Bill? Do you see the Obama administration, after the way this midterm election is shaping up, turning to the center, turning to the left? What's the new flavor coming?
Well, we don't know. No surprise here. I hope they move to the center. I hope they do after, like Clinton did after 94. I think that would serve them well. More important, I think it would serve the country well. You know, I think with Emanuel leaving, probably an organization can't withstand a personality like that for too long. So probably it's a good thing for change. But I think it's mostly the staff changes are an inside Washington story. The real question will be what happens in the elections and where does the White House go? I also would add, where does the Republican Party go? There was a poll this week in Wall Street Journal showing that I think 71% of Republicans identify or support the Tea Party, and that included some centrists. The question, though, is will they be able to govern? Because that same poll revealed that the folks who are supporting the Tea Party, they are not in a negotiating mood. And guess what? We could have a Republican Congress and a Democratic White House. There's got to be some negotiation for the country's good.
Well, look at both parties, and there's the White House, Jack. Kind of, I don't know if right in the middle is the way of putting it, but we've got Obama, President Obama, telling the Rolling Stone, you know, that he's unhappy with liberals, progressives, who are walking away from him. It's inexcusable for any Democrat or progressive right now to stand on the sidelines, kind of scolding that wing of his support. Jack, what do you see in Rahm Emanuel's departure and the turnover to come?
Well, I'm going to miss him if for no other reason than the president got off some of his funniest lines about Rahm Emanuel at the White House Correspondents' Dinner a year ago. It was on the eve of Mother's Day. Maybe you can see where this is going. The president said, "This is a tough holiday for Rahm Emanuel. He's not used to using the word day after mother."
Great.
So we'll miss him. And already you see some of his obituaries sort of casting him as the political scapegoat for the administration's woes. Yesterday's Financial Times listed some of the reasons that his focus was really on a 24-hour news cycle. Who's going to win the cycle? He didn't have a larger strategic vision. That his pitch for bipartisanship essentially signaled the Republicans that the president had no red lines and that they could play him. And third criticism is that he administered the White House and the White House staff, but not the government, and that he let interagency business and cabinet stuff and so on, all that go by the boards.
Big decisions for President Obama as he watches the midterms unfolding, sees what are in those results, and rebuilds. Of course, it's very common to clean house around this time in a presidency, but he's going to have to make some real course-setting decisions here. Let's get our listeners in. Buffalo, New York. Jerry, you're on the air, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty well.
I'm hoping that the rubber and glue kind of school ground antics of Carl Palladino will ultimately come out statewide. So somebody who is really off color like that, who may have learned from Patterson's passing budget extenders on a weekly basis, to actually do the kind of things that he wants to do, that I think would be pretty scary for New York.
You're talking about Carl Palladino, the Republican/Tea Party candidate for governor, who's been very, very angry, done very well in the polls, with New Yorkers responding to that, but this week threatening to take out a reporter who got in his face. What about that, Jerry?
Well, I'm more concerned about the rubber and glue kind of thing, where he's accused of his extramarital affairs, and then he just throws stuff out there about Cuomo. My memory serves me, when Cuomo got his divorce, it was more about the affairs of his wife, not so much of his.
Yeah, saying maybe his opponent in the upcoming election has issues of his own, but who knows? He's got not much grounds to say that on. Nancy Cordes, what do you make of this? Carl Palladino, he's quite a talker, and he's talked very angry throughout his campaign. But here's, this video everybody's watching again and again. The reporter saying, "You're going to take me out? Yeah, how are you going to do that? You watch. I'm going to take you out," he says. Where are we headed here, Nancy?
Well, he has made no secret of his temper. In fact, his campaign slogan is, "I'm mad as hell." And that's kind of what he's running on, is this anger. This is the guy who sent out trash-scented mailers to voters. He called his dog his chief of staff. So Carl Palladino kind of revels in his unorthodox campaign style, if you will. He does have a temper, and this puts the Cuomo campaign in kind of a bind, because their dilemma is, do they take this guy seriously and by doing so elevate his status? The polls, unfortunately, are all over the place. As you mentioned, there are some polls that show him doing quite well. The Cuomo campaign has said, well, we have internal polling that shows we're doing just fine, but it really gives them a tough road to hoe, because they need to engage him, because we've seen other candidates in the past who have not taken Tea Party candidates on full steam ahead, and they've done so at their peril.
Bill McKenzie, you point out the new Wall Street Journal poll finds 71% of Republicans describing them as Tea Party supporters. And then you've got Carl Palladino, a Tea Party candidate, sort of, and he's threatening to take out this reporter, not backing off from that. Of course, he said later, take out the trash, but we know what take out means. It means kill.
Yeah, right. Right. If you're going to be mad with a purpose. If you look at that poll again, the Wall Street Journal poll, the top ranking issue for Tea Party folks is the debt and the size of government and the deficit. Okay, be mad about that. Have a constructive anger, if you will, and use that, channel that, turn it. We're going to have this debt commission report back after the elections, and hopefully we'll get some sort of roadmap from them of different decisions Congress should make. All right, Republicans, and I say this as somebody who's a moderate liberal Republican in philosophy, get serious. get down to figuring out what are you willing to deal with the White House on. Use your anger for a constructive reason. Just don't, use it to let you just vent for the sake of venting. I really have very little, I have no patience for that.
And yet, it's doing all right in the polls, at least as the Wall Street Journal found, at least as the primaries found. President Obama, his party not doing so great on the enthusiasm side. I guess that's different from anger, but still, here he was out in Wisconsin this weekend.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Whipping up the crowds, I should say, last week in Wisconsin, and then talking to them, encouraging them to kind of get off their duffs from their side of the political ledger.
The biggest mistake we could make right now is to let disappointment or frustration lead to apathy and indifference. That is how the other side wins. And I want everybody to be clear. Make no mistake. If the other side does win, they will spend the next 2 years fighting for the very same policies that led to this recession in the first place.
Nancy Cordes, what do you see coming on the midterm front? The Republicans sort of making some ground back on the Senate front this week. Maybe they can take it, maybe they can't. The president's out there working very hard in his backyard campaign.
That's right. The president is, in fact, making no bones about it at this point. He's literally saying to Democrats, you need to close the enthusiasm gap. And as we know, this enthusiasm gap is a measure of how much more fired up the right is than the left. And in a midterm election, people come out to vote when they're enthusiastic, and that side wins. And we've seen poll numbers showing that Republican enthusiasm is double Democratic enthusiasm, 50 points to 25 points. So he's now saying, look, Democrats, you may not like everything that I did. You may think that I went too far or I didn't go far enough, but you still prefer me to the alternative, so you need to get off your butts and get out and vote.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the week in the news today. Rahm Emanuel out at the White House, hot temper on the campaign trail. And we will talk with Bob Woodward about the president and Afghanistan later in this hour. Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial columnist there. Nancy Cordes of CBS News joins us from Washington, and our own Jack Beatty. John Boehner, criticizing Democrats this week for what sending everybody home without action to extend Bush-era tax cuts. Here's the Republican minority leader in the House.
And how any member can vote to adjourn and pump this into a lame duck session, I think, is putting your election above the needs of your constituents.
There's big stuff, tax policy out in California. I don't know, call it big or small. Republican gubernatorial candidate Meg Whitman came under fire this week after news broke that she had employed an illegal alien for 9 years. Speaking to Good Morning America Thursday, she denied knowing the status of her employee.
We hired Nikki. We used an employment agency. Nikki provided her Social Security card, a California driver's license. She filled out a 1099 because we told the employment agency we have to hire only people who are documented to work here. So we had no idea that she was not here legally.
Bill McKenzie, California is a ways from Texas, but you know the illegal immigration issue well. How does it look as a campaign issue this year? Does this look tough for Meg Whitman?
Well, you know, as a moderate Republican myself, I'm hoping people like Whitman break through. But I got to tell you, this is a sort of issue I think that could take the wheels off of a campaign. You know, this is sort of kind of a flashpoint, and it perhaps can be a symbol to people, and it could stick in their minds. We don't know. I mean, she is running against Jerry Brown, and no offense to Jerry Brown, but his day is kind of come and gone. So I still have a feeling she wins. But this could be a really symbolic issue there.
Running against Jerry Brown has spent, what, $100-$150 million of her own money on the campaign. This is the eBay CEO and very wealthy woman with that old nanny immigration issue problem on her plate. Dennis in Marion County, Iowa. Dennis, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, and perhaps your experts there could talk about this, we're seeing the polls the way they are. Here in Iowa, our governor's behind by 19 points, and he's a Democrat. And we hear about the enthusiasm gap with Democrats and all of that sort of stuff. But yet, when we look at the requests for early ballots, which you can start voting in Iowa on September 23rd, four times as many Democrats have requested early ballots as Republicans. And I know there are early voting mechanisms in many states. Texas, I used to live there, and they have really early voting. And I'm curious as to how that request for ballots is matching up to the various polling and surveying that seems to be all over the boards.
Well, that's interesting. Iowa, of course, may be resonating with President Obama's call to get out. They played such a big role in him coming to prominence in the first place. I don't know, Nancy. Early requests for ballots, there's a lot of that that goes on these days. Do you know how to read those tea leaves?
I don't, and that's actually fascinating. I had not heard that Democrats were requesting early ballots in such large numbers in Iowa. Unfortunately for Democrats, the news on the national front is not so good. We've seen, as you mentioned before, certain races like the Senate race in West Virginia, which was never expected to be a close call for the very popular Democratic governor there who's running for Senate to take the late Senator Byrd's old seat. He was expected to easily take office, and now he's neck and neck with his businessman competitor from the Republican Party, and we're seeing races like that all over the country.
Let's get a call from John in Beverly, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Jack. I don't know who else is there, but Jack, I always appreciate your comments. My comment is this, and I never hear it talked about, not once, and I follow this stuff regularly, is that wealthy people do not make investment decisions in business or otherwise based on tax policy. If you're going to take away 3% from a wealthy person from their income tax, if you're going to add 3% to their income tax, they don't all of a sudden decide, oh, because I've got this extra 3%, I'm going to therefore invest in a business. They just don't do that. They make decisions based on their own net worth, their own intuition, their own creativity, and it has nothing to do with tax policy, and I never hear that talked about.
John, we've got I'll take it to Jack Beatty, since he's your fave here with Bill McKenzie and Nancy Cordes. But, Jack, we had the former Ronald Reagan's former budget director, David Stockman, on this week saying, you know, he thinks the Republican position on the deficit and taxes, he's now calling it a big lie, very critical of President Obama as well, saying, you know what? We can't afford to give the middle class a permanent tax break in this country. But John just doesn't buy, I guess, the GOP argument that don't touch those top end tax rates or you're going to crunch investment in this economy.
That's one of the fundamental assumptions and sort of suppositions of supply-side economics, that marginal rates affect investment, and that you get that right and suddenly investment goes up. And they point to things like the quote-unquote boom in the Reagan years when marginal rates were lowered on the wealthy. And sure enough, the economy went forward, and ipso facto must be evidence. Well, of course, the opposite evidence would be from the Clinton years, when taxes actually went up on the affluent, and we had an even bigger boom. So it's not at all clear that the Republicans are right on this one. I think the decision this week, we had Congressman Boehner saying the Democrats should have voted. A lot of people on the progressive side think they should have voted too. The New York Times speaks of profiles and timidity of the Democrats not forcing a vote on this tax cuts for the top 2% and not forcing the Republican Senate to filibuster, which I think they might have done, the middle class tax cut. And some people think the Democrats' last chance of pulling out something from this election was lost with that.
Let's get a call from Jeff in Nashville, Tennessee. Jeff, you're on the air.
Yes. I would just say I like your show too, Tom. Thanks.
Thank you.
The Tea Party people, ordinary people, never been in office before, are winning seats up and down the United States. We as Americans, I believe, we're sick of Republicans, we're sick of Democrats, and we're just sick of them going year by year, you know, 10, 15 years, and nothing's getting done. They're not voicing for the American people. And I would say that this is a strong movement in the next 2 years, not just this election coming up, but in the next two-year election. It's going to be very strong, and we are going to roll over, hopefully, the status quo. That's my prayer anyway.
Jeff, let me ask you, we get where you're coming from. You want to see that happen. Given that, what did you think of Carl Paladino in New York this week saying to the reporter, you know, do that again, I'm going to take you out? Are you sympathetic or whoa?
I would say that he's you could hear the frustration. He's frustrated. And he just is voicing it. I don't think, we all get uptight. I think it was just, he was just really upset. I think that's not going to, it's not going to hurt him that much. So I really hope that it goes well. I think the Republicans are going to do well coming up in November.
Jeff, I appreciate your call from Nashville. Bill McKenzie in Dallas, there's Jeff, and he, he says he's sick of everybody, Republicans, Democrats. He's for the Tea Party, but of course, it's Republicans who are going to probably make the gains on the back of that energy. What,
right.
if they get majorities, Bill, never mind what Barack Obama is going to do with a new team in the White House, what would the Republicans do with a majority or majorities?
Well, first, they are going to have to tackle this long-term debt problem, as we talked about a second ago, and they're going to have some options coming up pretty quickly, and when we get down to Social Security, we're going to have to start facing some tough issues. Boehner, to his credit, has already said that he would be open to extending the retirement age for Social Security. We're going to be facing issues like that. We're going to have to look at Medicare, which is a very complicated financial dilemma. It's not easy soundbite stuff, but we're going to have to get into that. I am hopeful, though, and I'm biased here. There are people like Rob Portman. I know Rob, I've known him for a good while.
In Ohio.
Right, who is leading that race, I think, by 11 points. I have faith in people like that who he's been in the House. He was in the both Bush administrations, has good Democratic relationships, is certainly on the right. He's not on he's going to be more of a moderate conservative. So, people like Portman, if he's elected, Lamar Alexander from Tennessee, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, I really would hope to see them step forward and be able to come up with some consensus around these, various changes that we're going to have to make.
Bill, so you hope, but our moderate conservatives yesterday's headline. I mean, Jeff saying that we want to roll over you all, and he's talking, I think, about moderate Republicans as well. They've been losing in primaries.
No, and you're right. But once you get elected, what are you going to do with that frustration? I mean, you're going to have a template, in effect, of decision. You're going to have a list of decisions you're going to have to make. And at some point, you're going to have to turn all that frustration into, aha, these are the kind of trade-offs we have to make. And I'm frustrated, too. I get tired of this, of members of Congress who just fly back and forth from their districts solely so they can occupy the seat. And there is that. Having said that, if these issues were so easy, they would have been solved a long time ago.
But Bill, can I, if I
yes,
may,
Jared.
I mean, this week we've heard sort of what some Republicans want to do with the frustration. For example, in the Senate, Jim DeMint, Senator from South Carolina, says that he is going to require every bill that comes up to essentially be cleared first with his office. And if he doesn't like it, he's going to set up procedures, essentially put a hold on it, that would require, well, here's the kind of thing it would require. If his procedures had been in place since August, since then the House has passed 372 bills. Who knows what they're all about? Maybe 10 of them were significant. But according to one calculation, that would take 2.5 years for the Senate to deal with that under the DeMint rules, stop the Senate from acting. That seems to be his major objective.
Let me put that, if I may, to Nancy. Nancy, would a King DeMint just bring everything to deadlock here? Throw the brakes on?
It's not just DeMint acting on his own. We are looking at the possibility of maybe 5 to 7 Tea Party candidates storming into the Senate. And these are people who have stated that their goal is to get as little done as possible. They think government does too much and they want it to do less. Some of them want to dismantle Social Security or dismantle Medicare. So when you talk about finding compromise to try to solve some of these very, very difficult issues, these are people who are not interested in compromise. They want to hit the brakes. So compromise with some, yes, you do have a few moderate Republicans who might be taking office, but right now, moderate Democrats are trying to keep their moderation under wraps, and it's really the Tea Party that has the energy in that party.
I want to look at this young man off the bridge in New York, and we will do that. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Joyce. Joyce, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, panel. Nice to talk to you today.
You too.
I was absolutely sickened and appalled when I heard about this story the other day. And I was thinking about it after some of my rage.
Are you talking about Tyler Clemente, the Rutgers student off the bridge, Joyce? Yeah.
Yes, I feel very bad for him. But I'm more concerned about the people that did this, that felt that somehow, in their twisted minds, it was okay to do that. I'm really concerned overall for our society that this is something that anyone would even think of doing.
This was a roommate and another fellow student who filmed him and streamed live online. His sex happened to be gay sex, and this talented young musician is dead.
It wouldn't matter. Gay, straight, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The mindset that allows somebody to think, to even consider the fact that they could do that to another person, worries me. And I just don't know what we can do to address it. People are talking about bullying laws, but I don't. It's not even that. It's just the thought of doing that is insane.
It's pretty upsetting. You say gay straight doesn't matter, and maybe not. On the other hand, here on ABC on Wednesday was a gay rights activist Dan Savage talking about the suicide, maybe part of a larger problem.
Gay kids are 4 times likelier to commit suicide than straight kids. 9 out of 10 gay kids report being harassed. And then, you know, the religious right turns around and says, look at the suicide rates among gay young people and gay lifestyles unhealthy, when it's actually the persecution that drives them to this.
Michael in Northampton, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Yeah, you know, just similar feelings. Absolutely tragic loss of this poor child. I believe he was a freshman at Rutgers, if I have that correct.
Just arrived, that's right.
I'm a Rutgers alum, so it's, you know, it's embarrassing for the university that there would be students like this who, just like the previous caller said, would even consider that this is okay. But I also do believe that it's quite upsetting that still in this day and age, gay kids are tormented and are looked upon as so fundamentally different or worth teasing. You know, that this would be something that again, kids would feel is okay to do, but take some joy or satisfaction.
Yeah, teasing to death in this case, Michael. I appreciate your call. I mean, it's hard to read this in a way. On the one hand, you can just see it. There's a consideration of hate crime charges here. On the other hand, everything seems to go on the web these days. Mm-hmm. You know, Nancy, you know, does that make it anti-gay or just oblivious to borders, to sort of boundaries?
Well, I think it does bring to light a big societal problem that we're going to have to tackle, which is that children from a very young age now are spilling their entire lives online. They're spending hours texting and on Facebook, basically putting their entire lives out there.
But Tyler Clemente had this done to him.
Exactly. But I'm talking about these two 18-year-olds who may not have understood the boundaries that, you know, yes, you're used to saying everything that goes on in your life online, but this is not something that's appropriate to say online. I don't mean to diminish what they did in any way, but I do think that kids don't understand boundaries right now.
Bill McKenzie, hate crime here when a roommate puts his roommate's sex, and it happens to be gay sex, online, hate crime?
Well, you know, I don't know the strict definition of hate crime, but I have no problem if it being investigated in that way, and I think they should. But I think we have that, the hate crime bullying aspect of it, and then we have the other side of it is that your first caller kind of put her finger on. I think we live in a period where the whole notion of self-restraint is kind of going away. I heard President Obama's Trade Secretary Ron Kirk speak here in Dallas last weekend, and he was said, not about this, but about something else, he was saying to his staff, who was all younger, he said, you know, it's okay to have an unexpressed thought. And I think that's kind of what we're dealing with here in a broader sense, going beyond this episode, is we have a generation, as Nancy was saying, in fact, who express every thought that comes to their mind. And there's got to be some zone in there where you have some element of privacy and some degree of self-restraint.
Bill, I have to just note, we're awfully glad that the guy with the rifle on your University of Texas campus this week got no further than he did. We're glad that that ended up unexpressed. Lucky for everybody. Bill McKenzie with the Dallas Morning News. Thank you so much for being with us today, Bill.
You bet, Tom.
Nancy Cordes at CBS, thank you.
So glad to be here.
Jack Beatty, stand by. We've got Bob Woodward on the way. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Bob Woodward was famously there for the Watergate story and many since. This week, he's out with his big new book, Obama's Wars. It's about the very tense backroom drama in pounding out President Obama's Afghan war policy. This week, that story is hot, and hot right across the border into Pakistan. One Point News analyst Jack Beatty is here, and Bob Woodward joins us now from Washington. His new book is Obama's Wars. Bob, welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
You've been talking a lot this week. What's the big insight you hope Americans take away from all the reporting you did for this book, Bob?
I guess it's always complex, but we are committed in this war. But when you get into the detail, because I take you inside the White House and it goes on pages, the meetings, exactly what Obama says, his questions, mm-hmm. what the key national security people have to say, he sent 30,000 more troops there, but he wants out of Afghanistan. He wants out so much that he kept in these top secret meetings saying things like, this needs to be a plan about how we're going to hand it off and get out of Afghanistan. There cannot be any wiggle room. In my newspaper, The Washington Post, this mm-hmm. morning, there are three op-ed pieces essentially focusing on the book, and I was struck that from the right, Charles Krauthammer asks, what the hell is going on? And from the left, Gene Robinson asks essentially the same question.
Krauthammer asking, if he wanted to get out, why did he go in heavier? And Eugene Robinson asking the opposite, if he wanted to get out, why did he go in heavier? Let's listen back for just a moment, if we could, Bob, to that sort of defining moment for this president, and that were publicly, this was December 1st of 2009, President Obama declaring a troop surge in Afghanistan.
As Commander-in-Chief, I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. After 18 months, our troops will begin to come home. These are the resources that we need to seize the initiative while building the Afghan capacity that can allow for a responsible transition of our forces out of Afghanistan.
Out, the word, and in, the word there. Bob, it sounded clear there and simple, but the back room, what, much more than dickering that went on to get to that policy. I mean, you say the president had to come down very, very hard to get the Pentagon and more to go along.
Well, it wasn't so much that. He was looking for options, and they wouldn't give him options. The Pentagon and the military wanted 40,000 troops. He eventually decided on 30,000 by devising his own strategy. But this is the kind of microscopic view of what life is like in the Obama White House. And, for example, there's a scene on the eve of this decision where Vice President Biden comes to the president and said, you've got to limit the escalation here. You have to tell the military all kinds of things they cannot do. If you don't, we're locked into Vietnam. And the background music in this is very much Vietnam, still that war that we lost and the concern that we get into something and we don't have a way out. Obama then said something that I found pretty much more than interesting. He said to Biden, if what I proposed is not working, if they find that out to be the case, I'm not going to be like these other presidents and stick to it based on my ego or my politics, my political security, end quote. That's his declaration. I'm not going to be caught in a Vietnam. I'm not going to be President Lyndon Johnson.
Of course, Bob, that's when President Obama's poll numbers were way, way up there. They've fallen a lot. Do you sense that same determination in the White House today? If the war's not going well, that this president would say, you know, no, we're out of there? Or do, you know, political mandates come in and say, you can't turn and run, it would be put, I guess.
Well, that's a good question. It's hard. And he has a series of decisions that are going to come to him in the coming months about the war, about the war on terror, about what to do with Pakistan. I mean, Pakistan is the most complex problem because, by all accounts, bin Laden is in Pakistan in a safe haven, as are other al-Qaeda leaders. the Taliban insurgency leadership is also in Pakistan. As the president says in one of these top secret meetings, the cancer is Pakistan.
Bin Laden may be in Pakistan, the Taliban certainly. Pakistan itself in an adversarial relationship with the United States this week. And Bin Laden, just today, as you probably heard, Bob, an audio tape is out allegedly from Osama bin Laden today, posted on an Islamic militant website. Here he is, reportedly calling for the creation of a new relief body to aid Muslims. Authenticity not yet confirmed, but listen in.
إن الحمد لله نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله.
Reputedly, Osama bin Laden here in a tape we haven't heard one in a while, saying what governments spend on relief work is secondary to what they spent on armies, and on in that vein. And that's just out today. Sid in North Augusta, South Carolina, you're on the air with Bob Woodward. Sid.
Hey guys, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering why we put so much resources in Iraq, sending all our forces over there, we're finally occupying the country, as opposed to going into Afghanistan, which I believe we had intelligence that suggested that that's where most of the training camps and along with the Pakistan and where all the training camps came or were established, and also where, like I said, intelligence suggested that maybe that's where Osama bin Laden was. And I'll take my answer off the air if I can.
Thanks, Sid. Bob?
That's a good question. And, of course, President Obama, when he was a candidate running, said exactly that, that that the Iraq war was a mistake, an overemphasis, and we should have completed the job in Afghanistan, because right after 9/11, we went into Afghanistan and the extremist Taliban leadership moved to Pakistan, and that war went on, and it's a civil war of sorts. But the mess on the president's hands in this whole situation. In the book, I reprint the secret orders he issued after he gave that speech, saying he was going to send 30,000 more troops mm-hmm. in. And in the secret orders, he lists four risk factors. In fact, one of his generals tells him the risk factors are so great, this is not a calculated risk, but you are taking a gamble. And those risks, one is Pakistan, two is international support, which is dwindling. Mm-hmm. The third is the Karzai government, which is in the news almost every day with some erratic idea or proposal or statement. And then the fourth and key, and this is the ticket out for the U.S. forces to train the Afghan National Security Force, the army and the police, and the data shows that the number of people that they enter into the force is less than the attrition rate. Is one of the people says at this meeting, it's like pouring water in a bucket with a big hole in the bottom. You can't ever fill it up. You can't get to that point where you have enough force to really turn it over to the Afghans. So as somebody was telling me the other day, I mean, this kind of blows the whistle on what's really going on. And if you look at a lot of the public statements, and they have this coloration, and quite frankly, I was in the Navy during the Vietnam period, and I hear some of that language of optimism, progress, we're going to handle this, and in the end, we may.
We may not.
But the picture is quite dreary now.
Bob, let me ask you, you got the inside dope here. I mean, the president out in public in his campaign was saying this Afghanistan war and the Pakistan situation, this is the vital war, you know, we've got to complete the job, as you say. This is intolerably dangerous. Did any of his generals throw that back at him in these private meetings and say, how can you talk about setting a date for getting out? This is intolerably dangerous. You were right on the campaign trail.
Well, here's one of the little twists in this. During the secret meetings, Secretary of Defense Gates said at one point, well, we can begin thinning out our forces in 18 to 24 months. Obama seized on that one sentence
mm-hmm.
and said, ah, okay, the Secretary of Defense, who's somebody who has a lot of respect in the country and in the military and in the White House, he said, we can do this. So that's what caused him to set this July 2011 date to begin
thinning.
Withdrawing or thinning out forces. So he leveraged the Secretary of Defense on this, and I've heard very reliably the Secretary of Defense doesn't remember saying that, but it's in the notes of the meetings.
Let's get a call from Chicago right here. And Jose, you're on with Bob Woodward.
Yes, hello. Question, how did Mr. Woodward come up with the title Obama's Wars?
Let's take it right there. Thanks, Jose. Bob?
The focus is the war he said he was going to take seriously, the Afghan war. But it also is the war on terror, which is connected because in the safe havens in Pakistan, they are plotting all kinds of attacks on the U.S. homeland. And the third element is the war within the administration between the White House and the military, the tensions there, which are quite serious, have not really been resolved. Put all this together, and we are in a very unsettled situation with the war, and the president's going to have to decide who takes Gates' place, what exactly is the strategy. Does he, in a very direct way, have the will to win this war, or does he look at it just as a short-term investment with the focus on the exit?
Let's get a call from Morgantown, Kentucky. Eric, you're on with Bob Woodward.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
My question is this. If we know that Pakistan is protecting or giving a safe haven to these units and terrorist groups and all this stuff, why don't we have troops alongside the border troops with Pakistan's troops instead of our troops being fired upon by the Border Patrol, like the incident with the helicopter? And I've noticed the drone strikes in that zone has really went up. They're really focusing a lot of efforts in that area. Why aren't we working with Pakistan more? Because it seems like if we keep working against them, we're going to cause war number three, and that's going to be us against Pakistan.
Yep.
Because we've made them mad for chasing the insurgents from going across the border.
Eric, let us pick that up. Bob?
You hit on the problem. Pakistan, 2 days after Obama was elected in 2008, the intelligence people went in with all the secrets, and one of the things they told him is Pakistan is living a lie, that they helped the United States in fighting some of these terrorist groups, but they also support them. They have done a good deal. When I interviewed President Obama, he said, oh, look, on counterterrorism, Pakistan is helping us, and I pointed out, but not enough, and the president gave a one-word response, which was exactly. So here is an ally that has an unstable government, has an intelligence service and military which is dominant, more dominant than the civilian government. They've supported these extremist groups historically because they don't want anybody to have too much influence in Afghanistan, because then they feel surrounded by India, the arch enemy, and Afghanistan. So they dabble and support the Taliban. But the caller is exactly right, and I quote CIA Director Leon Panetta saying, we can't do this without some boots on the ground. They could be Pakistani boots or they could be our boots, but we've got to have some boots on the ground. So there's the CIA director who's controlling this covert operation with the drone strikes from the air, realizing that you have to get in there and do something. Now, of course, the Pakistanis, as we've seen in the last couple of days, are not happy about us crossing the border. They're worried about their sovereignty, quite rightly. So something's got to be worked out. I suspect President Obama is going to have to get the Pakistani leadership here, civilian and military, and they're going to have to form some sort of game plan to make real progress. And again, I mean, this is such a problem. A couple of months ago, CIA director, national security advisor, go to Pakistan and tell the leadership there, look, we've traced the Times Square bomber, if you remember that.
Sure.
Faisal Shahzad drove his SUV into Times Square with a makeshift bomb that, thank God, didn't go off. But if it did, CIA and FBI have tracked the training and the support to Pakistan. They told the Pakistani leadership this and warned them, if one of these bombs goes off, as the president told me, one man, one bomb, no one's going to be able to control what we do in response to Pakistan. We'll be back, even with a small terrorist attack in this country, in a 9/11 situation where people are going to say, do something. We've been attacked. Oh, this came from Pakistan.
And Bob, stand by. Jack, you've been reading on just that point. Just got a couple of seconds here, but you know what Bob found on just that point, Jack?
Well, we have a plan, Bob. You said a retribution plan to strike 150 sites in Pakistan, no matter what's at the site now. Could be civilians, could be a city. Who knows? But that's a state of latent war.
That's pretty big.
It could be, but as they told the Pakistani leadership, I mean, put yourself in the shoes of President Obama if you have an attack postmarked Pakistan, the upheaval, political and otherwise, in this country would be, as they told the Pakistanis, there's no way that the president is going to not have to respond.
Come back hard. Bob Woodward's new book is Obama's Wars. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, thanks for being here.
You.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.